Who says college hoops has an offensive problem? I'm your host, Matt Norlander, with the Eye on College Basketball podcast, and I'm bringing on Ken Pomeroy back to the podcast. And that line, Ken, was my lead sentence for my Nate Walters 53-point story for CBSSports.com last night. But I'm sharing it with you now because total blogger problems hashtag with this. I lost the whole thing. It was all deleted by accident. The webpage refreshed. And for any writers that are listening, if it's happened to you where you've got, like, you've worked for a story for like 40 minutes to an hour, you've built it up, and I was almost done. I mean, I'm talking 92, 93% done, and then it just disappears. It is, I can't even describe it. It feels like someone has just taken your guts out and you don't even believe it at first. Welcome back to the podcast, man. We're recording this just after this happened on Thursday night. There are still games going on. I had to like drop everything. I was like, you know what? Ken and I are going to record. So how you doing, buddy?
A little therapy here for you, I guess.
It is.
That's awful. I mean, I've done the same thing, and it's just a completely horrible feeling when that happens. But, you know, the 53-point effort lives on, Matt. That was not a race, so that's there forever.
Exactly. The 53-point effort does live on. And the most points in a game, in a non-overtime game in college hoops since Jody Meeks besmirched Billy Clyde and put up 54 in mid-January back in 09. I didn't realize that it actually had been that long. And the weird thing was, I remember thinking about a week or two ago, just kind of mulling over possible blog posts, and I still haven't done the research yet, but I was like, where has the, you know, kind of semi-casual 40-point game gone in college hoops? And then Walters goes out and puts 53 up in a game, by the way, no one saw. You know, I talked with Scott Nagy, and he said there weren't even 500 people in that arena there. But hey, I just like the fact that we had one of these nights that we, you know, and it was him. I remember us talking in the preseason, Ken, you were like, he'll probably lead the country in scoring. He's number three now.
That's good. Yeah, he made up some ground.
So where do you come out on, you know, since Walters is one of the big topics here, where do you come out on his season so far? He's a top 12 Cousy finalist, certainly still playing well. It remains to be seen if he'll be drafted or not, but has he lived up to your expectations or no?
Well, you know, I was a little disappointed in his scoring output. Obviously, he made up a lot of ground tonight on my prediction. I don't know that he's been all that disappointing. His numbers have been pretty solid. Three-point shooting improved, kind of like we thought it would. I think overall he's been pretty good. It's a little disappointing that his team got off kind of a slow start, although maybe they're hitting their stride now. But I was kind of hoping for maybe a little more national recognition for him, kind of on the shoulders of his team, you know, performing pretty well. And they've been good, but they just haven't been as good as we might have thought before the season.
Agreed. And there's an interesting three-way tussle up at the top of the Summit League with Western Illinois, North Dakota State, and South Dakota State. We'll see how that ends up going. The tournament could use someone like Walters for sure. Familiar face, good guard, and plenty of people continue to rib me on Twitter. When he was at like 40, 42, I started getting my at mention started flaring because I got South Dakota State fans letting me know whenever he's got a big game. So that's pretty interesting. We're going to hit a few topics here. I mean, obviously the Illinois over Indiana game, we'll get to that in a little bit. Ken and I have a Marshall Henderson dispute I think we need to settle here. So we're going to get to that as well. But I do want to just go big picture in general here. Have not addressed it too much on the podcast here and there with a few guests, but this is becoming somewhat of a half annoying and I think half realistic narrative where people are talking about the issues college basketball has. And I'm going to give you plenty of time to gab here. I don't know if I've ever talked so much at the start of a podcast as I have with this one. The deleted blog post is clearly getting to me. Maybe we should have waited till the morning. But anyway, people are saying offensive problems in college hoops. My thing is this, Ken. College basketball has never been perfect. Yes, it was a more fluid game when there was a 45-second shot clock. I'd like to see the shot clock go down to 30. I understand that helps the defense, but I think more possessions is good. But in general, the broad topic, where do you come out on college basketball is a broken sport? I mean, take that wherever you want. But this is now becoming some sort of tussle and a point of preference for a lot of columns. And I feel like it's going to bleed well into March.
Right. So, I mean, personally, like for guys like me and you, I don't think it's a big issue. And that's why, you know, when we see guys slam the sport, we think, you know, they're just a bunch of jerks who don't know anything. I think from a bigger picture, from like a, you know, kind of a general public picture, is a problem. And it's, but it's not just like this year it's suddenly a problem. I mean, this has been a trend that's been happening for the last 10 years. And, you know, I've written about it before. It's not an easy one to solve, but it's going to be an issue. I mean, you know, if we have a 43-39 game in the Final Four,
yeah,
you can bet that's not going to be treated favorably by the, you know, general press. So your point about the 30-second shot clock, I would imagine, like, they'll eventually go to that. They might go to that really soon, you know, in the next rules update. But like you said, that's a rule that helps the defense ultimately. I mean, it will, you know, cram in four or five more possessions per game maybe, and that will nominally increase scoring. But it doesn't solve the bigger issue of the game, not necessarily being broken, but certainly being extremely difficult for the offense to succeed at, or more difficult than it has been in the past. And if you're going to lower the shot clock, you have to do something else. You have to do something. You have to throw the offense a bone. You have to change the way the game's officiated. And the NBA did that very successfully, you know, 6-7 years ago. It's a lot more difficult in college because there's no central authority. You know, you have all these kind of fragmented conferences that have their own officiating styles, and you have officials that, you know, my referee in two or three of those conferences, but nobody in the Big East referees in the WAC or anything like that. So so you don't have that crossover, and that just makes it very difficult to enforce, you know, large scale changes. And if I can add one other thing, you know, those changes are going to have to be calling the game more tightly. And so that transition period is going to involve a lot of fouls being called. And you can pick whatever game you want. But I think the Ole Miss-Kentucky game was an example of this, where it was called very tight early on. And, you know, you can see the reaction on Twitter, and people didn't like it. And people don't like a lot of fouls being called. And so whatever transition period is going to occur, it's going to be received very negatively initially. And that's when you have a David Stern overseeing things, he can kind of say, hey, this is how it's going to be. Deal with it, people. But there's nobody like that in college basketball, and that makes it very difficult to kind of implement those kind of changes.
You are so dead on. If the sport is going to change, if the offense is going to get better, one of two things has to happen. What you're talking about, there's going to have to be a 3 to 4 year growing pain period, which in a micro look is going to be very frustrating on a game to game basis. It won't be every game, but it'll be plenty. There will have to be adjustments that are made, or and I don't see how this next option is going to happen, or offenses are just going to have to decide to be more freewheeling and dealing and want to have more possessions and want to, and you know, run at a 75 to 80 possession a game pace. That's just not going to happen, because what this also ties into is the high ball screen offense, which Bill has talked about on last Friday's podcast, is very successful. I did a story on Belmont last week, and Rick Bird, who basically is considered himself borderline allergic to the high ball screen, realized he didn't have a big guy to throw in the post like Belmont has had so often in the past. So even he was like, all right, I'll acquiesce, we'll go to it. And lo and behold, Belmont's still winning, and they're doing things differently and are still successful. So he's like, maybe we have something here. So that's the other problem, is that you've got coaches that want to micromanage and have these stagnant offenses. And ultimately, I think that's why we are where we are. All that said, though, I still, and I don't want to be like an apologist. I don't want to feel like I'm wearing rose-colored glasses, but I feel like this is just an easy attacking point for casual media observers to kind of go after college hoops. And yeah, there are some bad, bad games, but overall, the sport, I mean, come on. The past 2 weeks alone have been ridiculous in how much drama and just generally enjoyable basketball there has been, regardless if it was in the 50s or the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get me to say, like, bad things about the sport. I mean, that's, you know, if you like college basketball, if you're a college basketball fan and you follow the sport from November on, you know, none of this stuff is really a big issue. But I think it's a small issue. I mean, I'd rather watch an 80-70 game than a 50-40 game.
Totally.
To the extent that changes could be made to make that possible, I would be all for it. But it's an extremely difficult problem, and it's not going to be solved by the 30-second shot clock. I mean, you know, scoring's lower now than it was in any, you know, non-shot clock year since 1952. So there's obviously more going on than that. That said, you know, the 30-second shot clock is probably overdue, but that's not going to solve the issue. There's got to be bigger issues. Solutions will probably be somewhat painful, and somehow we're going to have to convince people to adopt them. But whether there are changes or not, you know, I'll always be a fan, and you'll always be a fan, and it'll still be a popular sport this time of year.
Yeah, right. I'm hooked for life, regardless. Now, what about all this change we've got at the top here? I mean, as we record this right now, I'm watching this highlight of Illinois beat Indiana again, and I can't believe what Cody Zeller was thinking. But clearly, we've got all these top teams keep losing. I think it's great. I love it. Any reason why this season seems to be giving us a little more chaos in the 1-10 rankings? This is based on perception, by the way. I have not done the research yet, but it does seem like legitimately at this point in the season, we're having numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 losing a little more consistently than recently. And of course, the Indiana and the Florida, and who else am I thinking? Oh, and Kansas. How could I? Kansas. I don't even know if that was real. That's why I briefly forgot that. But how do you explain it? What's your hypothesis?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think some of it is perception and not exactly reality. You know, you go back and look at the top 10 from last year this time, and, you know, I'm just taking a look at it. You know, you had Kentucky and Syracuse at the top. They both had one loss. But then, you know, you had a bunch of teams with 2, 3, 4 losses rounding out the top 10. So, you know, I think if you're just looking, going on a record basis, you're going to find that things are pretty similar this year to the way they were last year. And, you know, this whole notion about not having a great team, I mean, you know, it's so easy to say last year, yeah, Kentucky was a great team. But, you know, we'd say that after they had a great 6-game run in the NCAA tournament. You know, heading into the tournament, and they were, I believe, coming off a loss in the SEC championship game. And, you know, they were like a 3-1 choice to win the tournament. So they were far from like an odds-on favorite to win it. So so maybe there's a little more parity at the top this year. I think that issue is being overplayed somewhat. And I say, you know, let's wait another month. Indiana's going to take losses. Michigan's going to take losses. They're playing in one of the most difficult conferences, you know, ever constructed. So they're going to lose some games. But they still could be really good teams. And I'll be curious to see how that plays out. You know, we might have a wacky tournament, we might not, but I don't know. There's as much parity as people are giving the season credit for.
Yeah, it'll be interesting once we get to turning time how it plays out. We've had some pretty ridiculous tournaments in the past 6 or 7 years, and I just wonder if it's just going to be a case once again where the latest tournament is just considered the wackiest and craziest ever. What about the best team though? Right now you still, you know, as of this recording, Florida's still number one. So that's what your machines are telling you, but I want your opinion, man. That's why I bring you on and not your website. So who is the best team in college hoops right now? Is it Florida despite that, pretty thorough smackdown by Arkansas a couple nights ago?
Yeah. I mean, it's always tough to judge a team after their worst performance. And so, you know, we actually now with Indiana losing, we kind of have both Indiana and Florida after a couple of pretty questionable games. And obviously both those teams are better than they showed in their last game. And, you know, personally, I think they're the top two teams, and I don't really know which one's better. I'd give Indiana a slight nod, I guess, over Florida. Probably Michigan third. But, yeah, Florida is clearly overrated in my system, and I, you know, kind of took great pains to make that point over the weekend and in previous interactions with people.
People?
Yeah, with actual people. Rare that I do that, but you know, they're very good. They're not as good as they looked in their first 8 SEC games. That was ridiculous. They probably got some benefit of playing teams that just didn't have good games. They probably got some luck in that respect. They probably played over their heads themselves. They're still a great team. They still could be the best team in the country, but nobody's as good as they looked in the first 8 games. And there was a little bit of a, you know, market correction when they played Arkansas. And if you saw that game, I mean, Arkansas played outstanding. It was clearly Arkansas's best shot. They were, you know, making shots, making three-pointers, and not a great outside shooting team, but they got hot early. Florida, you know, was missing stuff. You know, they got some good looks and missed shots, and that kind of, you know, snowballed. And that's what you get sometimes. And I don't think we'll see that a lot in Florida the rest of the season. But certainly, you know, every really good team is capable of playing poorly. And Indiana and Florida have showed that on more than one occasion this year.
Yeah, it's just too tough to tell, and that's why I love what this season is doing and how it's playing out with Florida, Indiana, Michigan, Louisville, Duke, Syracuse, Ohio State, Gonzaga. I mean, you just go down. Arizona is a 20-2 team that's rated outside your top 10 right now. They're sneaky at this point, so we'll see what happens. Let's not wait any longer and get into this Marshall Henderson thing, okay? Because all right. So why don't you set this up? You kind of had an issue with the way. Did you feel that the national media and present company included set up Marshall Henderson to break him down, or was this more, hey, we weren't paying attention to his actual numbers, and so when he didn't play presumably that well against Kentucky, he actually played well? What's your case here, so I can go at it with you?
I don't think there's any conscious effort to build the guy up, just to simply break him down and ridicule him. But I mean, come on, it was a little bit weird that the entire season he's this freewheeling, gunning three-pointer. Has a history of being a little bit of a lunatic on and off the court. We know who he is. He's a fun guy to watch on the court. I'll give you that. And he's actually been pretty productive this year. But, they play Auburn. He has, not really his best game. It was an okay game. But considering they're playing Auburn, pretty disappointing. They win on his free throws at the end. Nail biter back and forth. I mean, it wasn't a very good game. It wasn't a very good performance by him. And he comes out of it just because he, did the whole jersey popping thing. He comes out of it, this cult hero. And it was amazing to me how it just kind of took off, the next 48 hours on the college hoops news cycle. I mean, the Marshall Henderson story just dwarfed anything that's happened this year. And it was kind of frustrating to see, people build this guy up to be some sort of superhuman basketball player. And I mean, you knew he was going to have trouble against Kentucky. I mean, he might have, he could have pulled an Elson Turner and gone off, but, Kentucky has a very good perimeter defense, and it wasn't surprising that he struggled, and I don't think he struggled as bad as people said, but, that was Marshall Henderson. That was his game. He takes a lot of threes. He's going to do that no matter what, and that game was probably warranted because, his teammates were getting swatted by Nerlens Noel every sixth shot. So,
yeah.
So anyway, if I laid out my frustration on the Marshall Henderson coverage.
Yeah, but here's where we differ, is that I think you were unfairly propping up what we were doing in regard to Marshall Henderson. Like, he was a story because the gif was hilarious, dude. Like, it was ridiculous that he was doing this against Auburn, and sometimes certain things, they just take off and become a life of their own. So I think people were more reacting to Henderson the person and Henderson the polarizing enigmatic player more than saying Marshall Henderson is super awesome and he should be considered the best player in college hoops. Now, I know. Wow. I know. Go ahead. I know what you're going to say. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, somebody did sort of imply that was possible. And
you can say, you don't need to be vague here, man.
Okay. Well, your buddy, Gary Parrish, implied that. And I mean, look, clearly it was about his personality. And if it's about his personality, fine. But don't say he could possibly be player of the year. I mean, look at what Elson Turner did up to the Kentucky game. He had this very similar status to Henderson. In terms of production, goes off for 40 against Kentucky. Nobody, talks about him at all. Marshall Henderson, kind of similar player. Well, obviously has a personality, so I get that. But after the game, I mean, I don't know if you got the same, Twitter mentions that I did, but a ton of criticism about Marshall Henderson. And people said, he was overrated. And I realized a lot of it came from, Big Blue Nation, and they were just ready to jump on him. But apparently, a few people out there interpreted the coverage as saying that Marshall Henderson was a really good player, not just that he was, this crazy personality.
Well, here's the thing, though, is that you've got Ole Miss and Andy Kennedy, who's never been to a tournament, all right? And they're nationally relevant for probably the first time ever, since Bryce Drew did them dirty in the tournament in '98, okay? Yeah. And so, for good or for bad, stuff like this, it becomes part of the I even hate how much I use the word narrative, but it does become part of the narrative because he is the guy spearheading Ole Miss possibly being a top two SEC team, getting back to the tournament. And so if he does that and he's the SEC leading scorer, and here's where I defend Gary, if because Gary set it up, it wasn't a post game, it was a pregame column. If Henderson had scored 33, beaten Kentucky, then like it or not, he would would have been in the conversation for National Player of the Year. Now, your stats can say that that shouldn't be the case, and when it all shakes out, that might not have been the case, but I totally get where Gary was coming from there, and I would even side from him. It didn't shake out that way, but if it had, then I would certainly understand, because considering his profile, and if he had had a big night against Kentucky and kind of solidified Ole Miss as the number two SEC team, I would have understood it. Do you get it from that angle?
I get it, but I also think you're really putting a lot of stock on the Kentucky game because he wasn't in the conversation at all before that, you know, in terms of National Player of the Year. I mean, he was kind of in the discussion for SEC Player of the Year, but, you know, does one game propel him from being, you know, completely out of the conversation to, wow, now he's a legit candidate? I mean, I think that's a little crazy. I mean, you know, whether you want to talk about it from a statistical perspective or just a logical perspective, you know, one game shouldn't have that much impact. It obviously didn't have that much impact for Elson Turner, and I understand the Texas A&M is not as good as Ole Miss, but up to that point, they had a pretty nice record, and there was no talk about him. So, you know, those kind of things bug me when people, you know, in the Player of the Year race, which theoretically should be determined by your production, ends up being influenced by somebody's personality. I don't feel like that should happen, and that was the source of my frustration with how the coverage went for those two or three days leading up to the game, and then the few hours after the game.
Yeah, no, I get you, and you know what? Someone's personality shouldn't necessarily influence if he's put into a Player of the Year conversation, but you're just never going to stop that. Like, I don't think I'd ever use it, but it'll be some sort of groupthink that factors in. And as we have this discussion, I'm very aware of the fact that Nate Walters, hello, had 53, and it wasn't on TV, and you know he shouldn't be in the Player of the Year conversation, but if that 53 came in a bracket buster game at 4 o'clock when there wasn't a lot happening, and he like carried them, like he carried them to that win. If he's not in that game, South Dakota State gets romped by a below 500 IPFW team, and stuff like that. Like one game, they can have huge reverberations. It's just the way, for good or for bad, a lot of people react. This is sports culture in 2013. Lament it all we will, but we do see when you do it in a spotlight, in a big moment, if it's a big game, that stuff does matter.
Sure. So if you produce in a big moment, great. I just don't know that there actually is that much precedent for a guy's personality affecting his status in a Player of the Year race. I mean,
yeah,
I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of Player of the Year winners over the past, you know, 10 or 20 years, but you know, certainly Anthony Davis didn't have this magnetic personality. I mean, people saw how he dominated a game repeatedly, you know, not just one time. So those are my thoughts.
No, I get it, man. No, it's good. I wanted us to hash it out there. I wanted to not, like, we could have gone through this over DM, but I was like, no, save it for the pod. Much, much better than that. I do want to address Kansas now. They were not the big, like, it was a crazy upset. Jerry Palm had tweeted that, you know, in his 20 years of tracking it, he doesn't remember a bigger disparity in his RPI rankings with one team beating another than Kansas in the top five, and forgive me, I don't have the exact number, but you know, TCU in the 270s or 280s. So there's that. But then, you know, there have been plenty of other bigger upsets. You believe that, because I think we disagree here too. So this is me proving to Goodman that, like, we don't always side on everything here. You think that if a team loses to TCU the way Kansas did, that is a statement that you can't possibly be good enough or elite enough to be counted on to win six straight games in March, whereas I more side with, maybe it's an aberration, and I'm not totally ready to write off Kansas. And I'll project hypotheticals. If Kansas loses only one more game the rest of its Big 12 slate, and say that's in the Big 12 semifinals of that tournament, I don't know that I'll not pick Kansas to win it all just because of this loss. But you're different, right?
No. Look, if they do what you say, I would, you know, cut them some slack. Certainly. I think, you know, based on what we know now going forward, that would be pretty unlikely. I can't see them winning out. But if they did that, yeah, I'd cut them some slack. I mean, I'm not one of these people that, you know, this one thing is, you know, disqualifying for winning a title. I mean, look, I don't think they're the best team in the country. I don't think they're one of the top five teams in the country. They've, you know, shown some cracks here for a while. They just happened to lose their last two games. But before that, they were, you know, struggling against some pretty mediocre teams. And, you know, pulling through with wins, so it kind of covered up some things. But, hey, if they turn it around and win out and you know, like you said, you know, lose one more game or whatever in the conference tournament, I think they would deserve some respect. You know, it depends how they win those games, of course, but I'm not totally throwing them under the bus. But, I mean, that loss is just different than any other, you know, loss we've seen from a top team this year. I mean, you cannot, you know, put that on the same plane as Louisville losing to Villanova or, you know, Indiana losing to Wisconsin or things like that. It was just a horrible, horrible performance. And you know, obviously Texas, TCU played well, but, you know, Kansas played pretty awful. And if you're capable of playing that bad when you're perfectly healthy, you know, that's a problem. I mean, that's a warning sign. And so Kansas would not be on my short list of teams to win the title right now, for sure.
That's true. I mean, the point guard issue is a serious problem. Bill Self has been saying that his team does have issues. How close is this rate? The other big one from this year is UCLA dropping at home to Cal Poly. This one was Kansas on the road to TCU. This one seems worse, but I mean, is the UCLA one in retrospect pretty closer because UCLA is now, a 17-16 after Larry Drew hit a buzzer beater to beat Washington? I mean, that's pretty close, though, too, because that one was bad. At the time, like, I dedicated some serious venom to UCLA. I said they were in trouble, and it's so funny when you look back at the time they were 4-2, but that one was ugly, so.
Yeah, but I think you were right to say that, and I think I think it's been proven since then. I mean, obviously, you know, they racked up some wins, but UCLA is not a top 25 team right now. I mean, they've struggled, and I had the same reaction you did after they lost to Cal Poly. Like, you know, this is a big problem. When you lose a game like this, it's an issue. And that upset wasn't as big as this one, but, you know, they both were the kind of upsets that sort of force you to really reevaluate your opinion of a team. And, you know, the other thing we tried to research on Twitter last night was this, what was the worst loss by a potential national title winning team? And I said, you know, a healthy team.
Yeah.
So, you know, ruled out the North Carolina loss to Santa Clara and the Michigan State loss to Wright State. But the best one I got was an 89 Michigan loss to Alaska Anchorage.
I got that, too. Someone tweeted me at that. But they were D2 with two, so.
But it's actually a pretty close call as to which loss is worse. You know, Alaska Anchorage was actually pretty decent that year against Division I team.
You still got the tape of those guys?
Yeah, I did. I think they went 2-3 against D1 teams. They had their three losses were like close to Kansas, Florida, and Utah.
Huh.
So it's kind of a close call. I don't know which loss was worse, but this one was bad. And to just say it was a bad night for them. I mean, you know, a bad night for Indiana or Michigan is a lot better than the way Kansas looked last night. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I still like. As that game played out, I mean, the thing that's almost forgotten is Kansas only had 2 points more than 13 minutes into the game. I mean, it was just so bizarre. I almost feel like 5 years down the road, I'm going to, like, want to go back to that and just kind of, like, write about it. Because it was just weird, man. Everything about that. Like, the whole everything. Like, Trent Johnson's non-reaction. You know, it was their first Big 12 win ever for that program. Just some really funky stuff there. I wanted to touch on Colorado State, who I am proclaiming right now will be a Sweet 16 team no matter what happens from here on out.
How?
I am, yeah. I'm just, you know, why not? Just throw something against the wall and see if it sticks. And the reason why is, so every Monday I do the Power Pyramid and I look at all these teams. I got to do a lot of research and I got to look into stuff. And it's fun, but it's arduous. And they are ridiculous, and you had finally pointed out, I had mentioned this in the pyramid once or twice earlier in this year, just what makes them so special/different, and you blogged a bit about it this week. You want to touch on that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, hey, I love the praise for Colorado State. I think CSU is kind of getting the short end of the stick in terms of the Mountain West race. A legit contender for the regular season title. And they have just been absurd in terms of their rebounding. And, you know, I blogged about it the other day. You know, it's not enough to say they're a good rebounding team, although certainly that's accurate, but they are excellent on both the offensive and defensive sides of the rebounding equation. Third in the country right now in offensive rebounding percentage at 42.6, lead the country in defensive rebounding percentage, allowing only 22.7. And that, you know, holding those simultaneous positions has never been done before for a whole season. And, of course, throw on top of that, they are extremely small. I mean,
exactly.
Their effective height is below the national average, you know, and the national average is not power conference average. It's the national average. So a lot of mid majors thrown in there, you know, the front line goes, you know, 6'10", 6'6", 6'5", something like that. And even, you know, last night against Nevada, they lost Pierce Hornung, who I believe was sick, had the flu, did not play. And so the front line is even shorter, basically, you know. Daniel Bejarano, 6'4", comes off the bench, great rebounder. But, you know, he ended up playing the three. But they still, you know, had an outstanding rebounding night and ended up pulling out that game. And it's an amazing story. You watch them play and you watch them rebound. And you know, Colton Iverson's obviously huge. But the other guys are just, you know, working their tails off, grabbing boards, grabbing loose balls. And it's a fun team to watch. They're no fluke, I don't think. I think they're a legitimately good team that should be mentioned in the same breath as New Mexico or UNLV or San Diego State.
Absolutely, and they are so fun to watch. I get pumped up when I watch them play. And the bizarre thing is, they don't really turn people over. So it's like their rebounding prowess is making up for the fact that they've got a turnover percentage on defense of 16.9, and that's in the bottom fourth of D1. There, I'm interested to see if that can have a little bit of an uptick. But if it doesn't, the reason why I say, you know, I can see them as a Sweet 16 team is that that's not like turning teams over. It helps, but if you're going to play in the half court sets and how the tournament can slow down, if you're going to be that reliable defensively on both ends, you're probably going to be able to overcome that. So interested to see. And let's remember here, I mean, it's Tim Miles' guys, but it's Larry Eustachy that's gone to Colorado State and continued this. And I've actually liked how Colorado State has continued to be good. And then Donnie Tindall down at Southern Miss, where Eustachy was, they, you know, Southern Miss has made three tournaments in their history, one of them last year, and Southern Miss has a big game against Memphis. Maybe they get back. I've just liked that how those two programs have stayed pretty good with new coaches. Elsewhere, I was going to throw some teams at you here and kind of give listeners, I did this on the Wednesday podcast with Goodman and Parrish, and they kind of liked it and they kind of didn't, but it was fun regardless. So screw those guys. I'm going to do it again because you've got your rating system. I want to give listeners an idea of different teams and what they should be expecting here, okay?
All right, bring it.
Okay, well, try and keep your responses within, like, you know, 20, 30 seconds, 10 seconds, your call, but no novellas needed. I've already, you know, wasted too much podcast time with my own. So Marquette, 16-5 Big East team, 22 in your rankings. Is this for real, or is Buzz Williams' new team more of a, you know, not necessarily faking it or fraudulent, but are they as good as that record would indicate?
Now, your setup was like more than 10 or 20 seconds, so
I know, I'm the worst, dude.
I should get like 40 seconds here.
Go ahead. Take all the time you need.
Yeah, I think they're pretty legit. I mean, you know, is their record, you know, worthy of their performance? I mean, they're not, you know, the second or third best team in the Big East. You know, they're behind Louisville, Pitt, and Syracuse in whatever order you want to put them in. But after that, you know, they're pretty solid. I mean, you got to give credit to Buzz. You know, I think he's done a great job there this year. You know, they're still playing well. Devontae Gardner has been outstanding, you know, and one of those guys who got very few minutes last year, put up enormous rate stats, and now he's getting more minutes and, you know, playing well if he can just stay out of foul trouble. So that was a really long answer. Sorry, Matt.
No, you're fine. No worries. No worries, dude. How about this right here? Here's a rankings quirk. You've got Middle Tennessee State at 20-4 and they're 45, and you've got Colorado at 46 as 14-7. Which do you think is the better team?
Well, they're probably pretty similar, right? You know,
I know.
I'm not going to pick who the best team is there, but I will take this time to make the point that Middle Tennessee is a really nice team out of the Sun Belt. They have no competition in that conference, so that's a problem, as it is, you know, it's been for like Belmont for past seasons. So who knows what to expect when they get in the tournament, if they do, hopefully. But, you know, I'll also make the point that the Pac-12, for whatever reason this year, is, I feel like, a bit overrated. I mean, who, you know, Arizona is a solid team. After that, like, it's hard for me to get excited. You know, maybe, you know, once Oregon gets healthy, they're worthy of getting excited about again, but not really sold on Colorado as being a team that's going to go anywhere in March.
Yeah, which is a little disappointing. I had them doing better at the start of the year. They've kind of dropped off a little bit. What about, let's go conference here. What about the Atlantic 10? They're eighth in your rankings overall. And if I would have guessed prior to the season, I would have had them. I would have had this conference top five.
Yeah, I mean, so the ratings are an average of the entire conference. So, you know, it's going to throw Fordham and Duquesne in there, and that drags the conference down a little bit. The top of the conference is pretty solid. You can make a case the top of the conference is better than the SEC. I mean, I love VCU. St. Louis has been rolling of late, blowing teams away. Butler's obviously been, you know, up and down, but at its best, really good. And, you know, you have LaSalle, which is kind of cause problems for those top teams as well. So at the top, it's pretty solid. Overall, from top to bottom, I mean, you know, eight sounds about right. There's some pretty bad teams in there, but at the top, it's certainly pretty decent.
From what you've seen, do you think Butler has a realistic shot? You know, depending on where they seed, I know it's seed and matchups, but if Butler ended up with a four seed, do you think they would have a decent chance at getting to Atlanta and Brad Stevens, you know, doing that yet again?
Yeah, so, I mean, you get into this box where, you know, it's Brad Stevens and you can't count him out. I mean, if there was no Brad Stevens factor, I'd be pretty pessimistic, I guess. I mean, certainly they have the ability to do that. They beat Indiana, they beat Gonzaga, so they have the ability to do that. They're going to need some breaks. And if you look at the times that Butler's gotten to the Final Four, they've had some breaks. So if they get breaks, they can certainly pull it off.
Butler beat Gonzaga. I want to go to Gonzaga. Right now, their offense is, at this point, it's their best adjusted offensive ranking in your system since it began. The only one that compares is that three-seeded team from 06 that ended in devastation with Adam Morrison crying before the game was over. I picked Gonzaga before the year started, Final Four, and I still really like them. Do you like them as much as I do, or is this going to be another season where we might see the Bulldogs fail to live up to seed expectation?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always tough to get to the Final Four. So if they didn't get there, I wouldn't necessarily call it a failure. But I do, I like them as much as you do, I'd say. It sounds like it. I think they're certainly capable of getting there. You know, the depth they have is amazing, you know, especially up front. I mean, you just don't see that in a team, you know, if you want to call them a mid-major, you don't see that really in a power conference team too often. But the fact that they, you know, have four bodies up front that they can throw out there, I mean, just makes them a little more bulletproof to, you know, wacky officiating in the tournament. So I think that'll help them. I think they're pretty legit and capable of getting to a Final Four. But you know, again, it takes some luck to get there. They probably need less of it than Butler does, though. They're a pretty good team.
Whether by ranking or your opinion, most underrated team, and by ranking I mean your system, most underrated team in the sport right now would be who?
Oh, gee, well, man, Pitt kind of jumps out at you. I would throw Iowa in there a little bit. I mean,
Iowa, really?
I mean, they've just been the victim of, you know, ridiculous things happening to them at the end of games against really good teams. And 3-7 in the Big Ten. Matt, don't give up on the Hawkeyes. Okay, they could still turn it around. The schedule actually kind of opens up for them a little bit in Big Ten play. If they can, you know, somehow get to 9-9 in the conference or something like that, I mean, I think they're a pretty good team, and they're completely forgotten about because every single close game they've had, except the home game against Wisconsin, you know, they've lost in Big Ten play, and so they have this awful record. But I think they're pretty solid. Maybe a year away from being really good, but they're pretty good right now.
Yeah, I've given up on them. They're 1-5 in games by 4 points or lower. I know the luck factor there. I think it's just too much to climb. But we'll see. We'll see. I'm not feeling the Hawkeye love. All right, well, let's go inverse here. Most overrated team would be who? Is it Miami sitting there at 10 in your rankings at 8-3, or is it someone else?
Yeah, so I mean, I have full respect for Miami.
So do I. I love Miami.
Yeah, I mean, I've touched on UCLA, and I guess I don't quite get the UCLA love. We could throw NC State out there as well. People seem to still be, you know, hanging with them, and I realize they're missing Lorenzo Brown, and maybe they'll be better when they get him back. But both of those teams, you know, came into the season with extremely high expectations, and you know, we've seen them now for, you know, 22, 23 games, and we kind of know what we have. And especially in the case of NC State, we saw them last year, you know, for a full season with, you know, mostly the same cast. I just don't think either of those teams are headed to do anything great in their, you know, respective, maybe in their conference tournaments, but not in the NCAA tournament. I don't think either is really a true top 25 team this year.
All right, good deal, man. Hey, this was an enjoyable little chat we had. I'm not nearly as shaky as I was to start the podcast. I'm still not feeling better. I still hate myself. But
try not to think about it. Still scored 53.
I know, man. It is pretty ridiculous. I'm just glad we had a big time score. It's just funny that it happened to be Nader's gonna Nate. So you can follow Ken on Twitter. Please do at Ken Pomeroy. Offers up good information, and he's got some sass to him too. So he's not afraid to go at it with people and toss out some sarcasm there too. So thanks for coming back on, man. We'll get you back on soon. You know, the snowstorm is coming, and I know you've got the meteorology, you know, that background there. So I'm going to be buried in this stuff. Should I be like totally worried? Is this like a snowageddon on our way? Are you up to date with this stuff or no?
I'm not. You know, I'm usually concerned about my local area, Matt. So I haven't looked at the forecast for greater tri-state, but I have heard the rumors that you are getting something, and I don't know. I love snowstorms, so I would be really excited if I was in your.
Oh, I'm totally pumped, and especially as a work-at-home blogger, so it's just, you know, I'll let the stuff come down. But yeah, that's looming and imminent in my future. So I figured we had to address that before it was all over. All right, maybe are you going to go? By the way, before we wrap up, are you going to like try and go to the Final Four this year? Or are you going to watch from your house?
I usually watch. Well, I've always watched from my house. It just seems like a horrible viewing experience to go to the thing. I realize it's a great networking experience, but.
No, it's a good time. You should do it. Like if you don't go this year, like you have to go to a Final Four at some point.
At some point I will, Matt. I promise you. I make that promise.
Okay. I was going to say, if you're there, we could do a podcast from there, but clearly...
Well, now there's incentive. Maybe I'll start looking into...
Well, listen, like, Atlanta's decent. You don't want to go to Dallas next year. And who knows when New Orleans is going to get it back. So if you're, like, getting picky and choosy, Atlanta's a decent spot. Maybe you wait till Indianapolis again, and I don't know. We'll see. I thought I'd bring it up. All right, man.
That's a good idea.
All right, thanks for coming on. We'll be back on Monday. Dana O'Neill from ESPN.com. We're finally going to class up this podcast and get another female on and do it right. So look forward to that. One of the best writers in the game. We'll talk to you Monday. Thanks so much.